Welcome, I'm Rose Aguilar, and this is Your Call. Last night, President Obama used his final State of the Union address to defend his domestic and foreign policy by focusing on what he considers to be the successes of his presidency. On the domestic front, he talked about the resurgence of the economy, the Affordable Care Act, higher high school graduation rates, and his commitment for access to preschool and college. And he also spoke about his foreign policy. He said that a strong U.S. military has boosted the United States' standing around the globe and has made America safer at home. So on today's Your Call, we are discussing President Obama's final State of the Union by focusing on his foreign policy. How has U.S. foreign policy changed under President Obama, and how would you describe his legacy? Joining us to talk about this is Andrew Coburn, Washington editor of Harper's Magazine and author of the book Kill Chain, The Rise of High-Tech Assassins. Andrew joins us from NPR Studios in Washington, D.C. Hi, Andrew. Welcome back to the show.
Hi, great to be with you again.
It's great to have you back. We're also joined by Tim Shorrock. Tim is a veteran national security reporter and author of the book Spies for Hire, The Secret World of Intelligence Outsourcing. And Tim also joins us from Washington. Hi, Tim. Welcome to the show. Hi, Tim. Are you with us? All right, we'll connect with Tim in just a couple minutes. So, Andrew, let's start off with you. So, in terms of foreign policy, President Obama is getting attention for a couple of things he said. He acknowledged that the United States spends more on the military than the next eight nations combined. And then, of course, he sounded nationalistic. When it comes to every important international issue, people of the world do not look to Beijing or Moscow. They call us. They call the United States. He's getting a lot of criticism, especially on social media, for saying that the conflicts in the Middle East date back millennia. What really stood out for you in the speech on foreign policy?
Well, I mean, you know, not all the things you've mentioned, which had me sort of writhing a bit in my chair. I think, yeah, people do call Washington usually often in terms of outrage, saying, what on earth are you up to? Because it's usually all too often Washington causing the trouble. But I'd like to focus on one particular thing he said. I'll just read it out. He said, fortunately, there's a smarter approach, a patient and disciplined strategy that uses every element of our national power. It says America will always act, alone if necessary, to protect our people and our allies. But on issues of global concern, we will mobilize the world to work with us and make sure other countries pull their own weight. That's our approach in conflicts like Syria, where we're partnering with local forces and leading international efforts to help that broken society pursue a lasting peace. I mean, that would have me sort of throwing things at the screen, because the partnership with local forces, let's start with that. Well, we're partnering, first of all, of course, with Saudi Arabia and Qatar in arming, effectively, as I wrote recently in Harper's, Al-Qaeda. That's our idea of a good partnership. I mean, you know, I don't want to go into all the details here, but we have, since almost the beginning, while professing our love for moderate secular elements in Syria, been enabling and facilitating, and in some place direct, some cases directly funding, weapons and, you know, support, money to people who actually are Al-Qaeda. I mean, you know, who fought with bin Laden, consider him, you know, mourned his death, adopted his policy of, you know, changing their name so they wouldn't sort of stick out so much. And, you know, and particularly shoulder to shoulder with noxious regimes like Saudi Arabia, you know, who chopped off more people, I think, this year than ISIS, chopped off the heads of more people than ISIS, and Qatar, who are, you know, rock rib supporters of the Muslim Brotherhood and of Al-Qaeda linked operations, and Turkey, you know, who are the, as Pakistan was to, you know, the jihad against the Afghans in the 1980s, so Turkey is the base area for the jihadi operation in Syria. And these are the people that Obama, this is the thing Obama was boasting about. I thought it sort of summed up the whole you know, what a sort of fiasco really all this high-sounding foreign policy pronouncements actually have amounted to.
That is Andrew Coburn. He's Washington editor of Harper's Magazine and author of Kill Chain, The Rise of High-Tech Assassins. And Tim Shorrock, are you with us?
I am with you, yes.
Hi, Tim. Welcome to the show. So what stood out for you in last night's speech, specifically on foreign policy?
Well, on foreign policy, what stood out for me, as someone who's been writing about East Asia for so long, is his only mention of East Asia is the Trans-Pacific Trade Partnership, which is just one part of a much larger policy toward Asia that the American people really don't know very much about, because all we know is that there's this Asia pivot. And he completely, ignored this massive military buildup the U.S. has been partaking in Asia. And as we were just talking about, these alliances with other governments to sort of, follow American policy in certain regions. This is happening in Asia, too, with South Korea and Japan in particular. Japan being led by a very militarist right-wing government that's, suppressing its people in Okinawa who want U.S. bases out of there to allow massive forward U.S. bases in East Asia. South Korea, similar kind of situation. And I think that, we completely sidesteps this issue of this military buildup there and the costs of it and how it's sort of increasing tensions in East Asia. And I find that, really troubling.
Well, this doesn't get much attention, Tim, but you wrote a piece for The Nation in November about a broad coalition of Okinawans who were in Washington to say we don't want new U.S. bases.
Right, exactly. I mean, you have the entire elected, all the elected officials of Okinawa, from the governor to every member of the national parliament, the diet there, to local officials, city officials, want no more U.S. Marine bases there. They want the bases moved out of Okinawa, as the U.S. has talked about before, to Guam. They want no expansion of this U.S. Marine base that's they're now trying to fill in this part of the island that's environmentally very sensitive to expand U.S. Marine base there, actually. And, the citizens there are sick of it. I mean, it's been like, basically a 70-year occupation by the United States of Okinawa, which takes up the bulk of U.S. bases in Japan. And, this issue is completely ignored by the Obama administration and completely ignored by the national security press here. And it's a question of democracy. I mean, the people have voted. The people have been lobbying. The people have come to Washington. They're trying to do the best they can to express their democratic, their opinions and try to, push Congress and the administration and the Pentagon to wake up to this. But it just hasn't happened.
That is Tim Shorrock. He's a veteran national security reporter and author of Spies for Hire, The Secret World of Intelligence Outsourcing. And now I would like to welcome Rami Khoury to the show. Rami is a senior public policy fellow at the Assam Fares Institute for Public Policy at the American University of Beirut and a senior fellow at the Harvard Kennedy School. And he joins us from Dubai. Hi, Rami. Welcome back to the show.
Thank you. Glad to be with you.
It's great to have you. So, Rami, I know we've got you for the next 15 minutes, so why don't we spend that time specifically on the Middle East? What really struck you about what President Obama said last night?
Well, I think it's the, almost any time that Obama or any American president in the last probably 20 years has spoken about the Middle East, it's been with a combination of kind of fantasy and arrogance, a combination of military power and moral superiority that the U.S. Brings to the table, that we're going to kill anybody who threatens us, we're going to defend our interests. They've got drones killing people everywhere, invading countries, toppling governments, trying to get rid of different leaders that they don't like, and usually not doing it very effectively. All of this creates greater opportunities for groups like Al-Qaeda and ISIS and others to grow and to take root, and you see it in Yemen and Libya and other places, in Syria, Iraq, of course. So the American approach to foreign policy in the Middle East, by and large, has been a combination of fantasy and futility, I would say. The only exception is the agreement with Iran. I think that was fascinating because the U.S. tried every policy in the book, including threatening war and sanctions and surreptitious, computer bugs. They tried everything, including probably with the Israelis some assassinations. And it didn't work. The Iranians wouldn't buckle. And the Iranians finally forced the United States and the P5 to accept the two basic things that the Iranians said, that they have the right to enrich for peaceful purposes under international inspections, and that the U.S. should not threaten regime change. So the Americans basically buckled in Iran. And I think this was an incredibly important historical moment. It was really a kind of a sign that the colonial period may actually be coming to an end, where the power like the U.S. can actually be forced into a negotiation. And, of course, the Iranians made some concessions, too, and that's what diplomacy is supposed to do. You meet the bottom lines of both sides, and both sides are happy, and for sure enough, the process is moving ahead. But I think that almost everything else the United States is doing around the Middle East in particular, which I know best, it has not had a very successful foreign policy. It's angered a lot of governments. The Saudis, for instance, who are a big ally of the U.S. and on paper, are angry with the U.S. It's angered public opinion all over the place. It's on bad terms with the Israelis. It's on not so good terms with the Turks. So almost every government in the region and popular opinion all over the region is critical of the United States. So I hope that the Iran experience would teach lessons to some people, but judging by the Republican and Democratic presidential debates, this lesson is not permeating the American political class, where you're still talking of carpet bombing and anybody who says anything. I mean, the response to the State of the Union by the governor of South Carolina was saying something like, well, we should be pleasing the Israelis, not the Iranians. So again, the impact of Israeli lobby groups on the American political system, especially in Congress, is so strong and destructive for American foreign policy that it is still causing a major problem for the United States. But Iran, again, was a case where the U.S. broke that chokehold. And so I think we're going to have to put up with this sort of double-edged American policy of realism in some places where they have no other option, but continuing militarism and arrogance in most other situations.
So, Andrew, what would you add to that? As Rami said, on one hand, the U.S. was forced to negotiate with Iran. On the other hand, President Obama came to office at a time when the U.S. was in the midst of two horrible, bloody occupations. 7 years later, the situation in Iraq and Afghanistan is getting worse by the day. He has taken a position on not getting directly involved. He often says, no boots on the ground, but he's mainly relying on drone strikes, and we'll talk about that, and then selling billions of dollars of arms to countries in the Middle East. So how do you square these two?
Well, I mean, I think it's all part of the same pattern. I agree with everything Rami Khoury has said, particularly the point about fantasy and arrogance. I mean, fantasy, I think, came into the line I quoted earlier. But it's all, you mentioned arms sales is very important. I mean, to a greater extent, I think, than a lot of people realize, I mean, part of the foreign policy, a big part of the foreign policy of the United States under Obama, certainly even before, but accelerated under Obama, has been arms sales. I mean, I think we have $50 billion worth of arms sales outstanding right now or more to Saudi Arabia. So you cannot look at U.S. policy to Saudi Arabia and the endorsement of this, what this rancid regime has been up to in terms of, bombing Yemen on a hourly basis and supporting jihadi terrorist groups in Syria and so forth, without recognizing that we have our arms merchants have a huge stake there, and we're prepared to swallow a lot just to just to keep that going. It's been in terms, Obama, I think he was also, certainly a few years ago, he was all set to go out on a boast about how he'd ended the wars in the Middle East, the America's wars in the Middle East, which he obviously hasn't. And in a way, I have to, having sort of, vented that way, I will give him some credit. I mean, he obviously doesn't like war. He doesn't like the Middle East, I know. He considers it an incredible irritation and sort of besmirching his legacy and occupying too much of his time. And he wishes it would go away. But he does, on the other hand, he unlike his predecessor, he's not eager to go to war there. So typical Obama fashion, it's a half of one and dozen, you know, six of one and half a dozen of the other. He doesn't, no boots on the ground, no, that's okay. But drone war, you know, slaughtering people with drones, and that's what the war on ISIS has essentially been. It's been a drone war, which, you know, doesn't really solve anything, in fact, sets you backward, because drones have a very counterproductive effect in terms of your popularity on the ground. It gives you a sort of feeling, gives the people, you know, US people feeling that something's being done, but actually nothing's being done. And it just sort of, it freezes a bad situation in place. That's been the war on ISIS. And the same with Syria. You know, no, he balked at actually bombing Syria, I'm glad to say, which he was about to do. But on the other hand, you know, he kept the war stoked. You know, he okayed or enabled, you know, arms shipments to these people I mentioned earlier. He, you know, this pretense that there was this vast secular opposition, which doesn't exist, or certainly doesn't exist now. So it's, you know, it's not only the arrogance and the fantasy, it's the sort of sheer stupidity that really annoys me about his foreign policy.
Tim, we got an email from a listener. Delmore in Oakland said, "I'd say Obama's foreign policy legacy is similar to Bill Clinton's. Two terms, no new big wars, which is about as much as we can hope for from the leader of the world's dominant power."
I wish Obama would take a page from Bill Clinton and negotiate with North Korea. I think when we talk about, look at what happened with Iran, the agreement that was made with Iran, I think that could be a model for a similar kind of agreement with the North Koreans, who have called for, you know, nearly a decade now for direct negotiations to reach a peace agreement to end the Korean War, which is still in a state of armistice, and there's still armed conflict. When we talk about arms sales, it's important to remember there was a recent report about U.S. arms sales around the world, which I think Obama was referring to last night. South Korea was the largest purchaser last year of U.S. arms. So this is a heavily militarized area, and instead of direct negotiations, instead of trying to find a solution to this very serious conflict in Korea, he's militarizing it even more. And at least Bill Clinton tried to negotiate with the North Koreans, and in fact, at the end of his administration, they had an agreement in place to end all missile production in North Korea and have recognition and cross-recognition and this kind of thing. But, you know, President Bush came in and ended that completely. But, I do think that, you know, in some senses, what struck me last night was when Obama said, you know, we're the strongest nation on earth militarily, and like hardly anyone clapped on the Republican side. Now that would be a line that would, you know, create enormous, you know, applause with any other president, I think. But it shows you the gulf between sort of this Republican, you know, fanatical imperial view of the world and Obama's more liberal imperial view of the world. So I think, you know, yes, there are, and you know, you have to look at Cuba. He did negotiate this with Cuba, and now we have, you know, open diplomatic relations, and things could open up with Cuba, I think, a lot. I think that's very important, and I think the negotiation is clearly the way to go, and I wish he would do that in Asia.
Tim Shorrock is a veteran national security reporter and author of Spies for Hire. Andrew Coburn is Washington editor of Harper's Magazine and author of Kill Chain, The Rise of High-Tech Assassins. And Rami Khoury is a senior public policy fellow at the Assam Fares Institute for Public Policy at the American University of Beirut and a senior fellow at the Harvard Kennedy School. Today we are talking about what President Obama said about foreign policy last night, what stood out for you, and what are your thoughts on Obama's foreign policy? How has it differed over the last 8 years? And what do you think his legacy will be? You can give us a call at 866-798-8255, 866-798-8255. You can also email feedback@yourcallradio.org. And we've got a question about ISIS. Let's go to David in San Francisco. Hi, David. Welcome to the show.
Good morning, Rose and all. I, seeing that there are a bunch of famous photographs of Senator McCain with the top leadership of ISIS from a couple or few years ago, and the ambassador that was killed in Benghazi was supplying arms to ISIS. I'm just wondering whether Obama can control the CIA or can control the military at any point. You know, looking at the rumors of the death of John F. Kennedy, that he wasn't able to control the CIA. Is the same thing happening to Obama, or is he a willing participant in the development and management of ISIS?
Rami, what are your thoughts on that?
I could hear nothing at all, so I'm sorry I couldn't say anything.
I could repeat if you'd like. Is that any better? Senator John McCain has been accused of the development of ISIS, and in fact the ambassador that was killed in Benghazi was also accused of sending Libyan arms to the early ISIS. I'm wondering whether or not President Obama has any control of the military or the CIA, or whether or not Obama is a willing participant in the management of ISIS.
Thank you for calling in. I think it's our phone lines. So, Rami, David said...
I heard that.
Oh, okay,
I heard
great.
That the second time.
Great.
I don't think the U.S. is involved in creating ISIS, certainly consciously, maybe unconsciously, unwittingly, and unknowingly. The U.S. is pretty lost in the Middle East. It doesn't really know the conditions on the ground. It doesn't get very far beyond the heads of state and occasional smooth-talking opposition leaders who go and hang out in Washington, as happened when the Iraq War started in 2003. So the U.S., I think, often does things that end up backfiring, like trying to help some Syrian rebels who end up being part of Nusra and al-Qaeda and things. Some of them then spin off and go to ISIS. But I don't think the U.S. does that deliberately, no. I think the U.S. doesn't understand what ISIS is. It sees it as a dangerous terrorist group, and it is a criminal group that does terrorism. But ISIS is a reflection of the calamity of the developmental and political patterns of the modern Arab world for the last 50 years. And the U.S. and England and France and Russia and Iran and Saudi Arabia and everybody have been directly complicit in promoting the kind of mismanagement, autocratic, misgovernment, corruption, abuse of power, disparities in well-being that ended up with the Arab world today, where something like half the people in the Arab world are functionally living at or below poverty level, where something like 50% of kids in a secondary school and primary school cannot read and write, have no chance of ever getting out of poverty. And you're talking of several hundred million people out of the 370 million Arabs who are living in very, very difficult circumstances. In fact, they're desperate, and some of these people spin off and create something like ISIS, which is, in fact, a combination of a motorcycle gang and a cult. Mm. But they control territory, they talk in the world in the language of Islam, they appeal to desperate people, and therefore they resonate with very small numbers of people. But ISIS is a reflection of all the problems of the modern Arab world, and unless Arab leaders and foreign leaders are willing to make the effort required to bring about the really serious structural reforms in the Arab world, and I'm talking about structural reforms like Gorbachev did in the Soviet Union, or F.W. de Klerk did in South Africa, where you completely change the system to try to help more people across the board. None of that is being done, and therefore ISIS is, like al-Qaeda before it, like other groups before them, these groups are going to keep emerging because desperate, frenzied, hysterical people who are afraid that their kids are going to die will go off and join any kind of group that gives them a chance of, in their view, of creating a better society. Of course, it's a mirage. It's a fiction. ISIS is not going to help anybody do anything. But the Western world, by and large, totally misunderstands what ISIS represents and therefore what should be done about it, because it requires that the United States change its whole attitude towards dealing with autocratic, dictatorial, non-accountable, non-elected Arab leaderships. And this is the pattern in all the Arab world, except for Tunisia now, which has changed a little bit. So the whole question of what ISIS represents and Qaeda before it, and the massive support for mainstream nonviolent Muslim Brotherhood Islamist movement since the 1970s, a tremendous wave where probably 70 to 80 million people around the Arab world supported the Muslim Brotherhood groups, and they won every election that they were allowed to contest in Jordan and Morocco and Tunisia and other places where you had open elections. People don't want to go and look at the root causes of the problems in the Arab world and address them. And if we don't address them, then ISIS and Yemen, Libya, and things like that is what we're going to keep getting.
Mm. Well, Rami, thank you. We would love to have you back and do an entire show on the fact that the West does not understand ISIS and also the root causes of why all of this is happening. So thank you so much for joining us. Rami Khoury is a senior public policy fellow at the Assam Affairs Institute for Public Policy and International Affairs at the American University of Beirut. And coming up after the break, we'll continue our conversation about U.S. foreign policy with Andrew Coburn, Washington editor of Harper's Magazine, and Tim Shurrock, veteran national security reporter. This is Your Call, and we'll be back after this.
This is Your Call on Local Public Radio, which is a better program when you get involved. If you have a question, idea, or experience to contribute to today's conversation, call 866-798-8255. That's 866-798-TALK, a toll-free number. You can also send an email to feedback@yourcallradio.org or leave a comment at the show's website. Set a bookmark for yourcallradio.org. Coming up at 11, it's World Have Your Say from the BBC.
This is Your Call. I'm Rose Aguilar. Coming up tomorrow, we will have a discussion about right-wing extremism in the United States. The Southern Poverty Law Center's annual census identified 276 militia groups last year, a 37% increase from 2014. Are we in a period of growing right-wing extremism, and what influence does the extreme right have on U.S. politics? That's tomorrow, and then Friday, it's our media roundtable, and if you have a show idea or a guest idea, you can drop us a line, feedback@yourcallradio.org. And if you'd like to join us today, we're talking about President Obama's foreign policy legacy. Last night, he used his final State of the Union address to defend his domestic and foreign policy issues, obviously. He talked about us having a strong military. He actually did acknowledge the fact that the United States spends more on its military than the next eight nations combined. He's getting a lot of criticism for saying that the conflicts in the Middle East date back millennia. So what stood out for you? How does President Obama's foreign policy differ than, say, George W. Bush or even Bill Clinton, for example? You can give us a call at 866-798-8255, 866-798-8255. You can also email feedback@yourcallradio.org. Today we're joined by Andrew Coburn, Washington editor of Harper's Magazine and author of Kill Chain, The Rise of High-Tech Assassins. Tim Shorrock is a veteran national security reporter and author of Spies for Hire, The Secret World of Intelligence Outsourcing. And Andrew, because you follow ISIS and the Middle East so closely, what are your thoughts on what Rami was saying before the break, that the West does not understand ISIS and what it represents and rarely really talks about the root causes of what is happening in the Middle East? I mean, President Obama, like so many Republicans, say this is a dangerous time. Priority number one is protecting the American people and going after terrorist networks, but never talks about the root causes of this.
Well, I half agreed with Rami Khoury. I mean, yes, you know, they certainly happy to agree that our leaders get it all wrong. I'm not so sure that, you know, this to say, well, ISIS represents, you know, poverty and misgovernment in the Arab world. That's true. I mean, so does, you know, I guess jihadism and, you know, all the other people that we've been actually helping, as I was mentioning earlier, the al-Nusras and things like that. But I would say in mild defense of the administration, they did. When the Arab Spring broke out in 2011, which was a response to the conditions that Khoury was talking about, the administration did greet it. They thought this is great. This is our way of, you know, getting behind a positive movement in the Arab world, which was a rebellion against the corruption and injustice and inequality of those societies. And they thought this is how we outflank the jihadis, as I wrote in a recent piece in Harper's. They thought this is very good, where this will be the end of Al-Qaeda, because the people that Al-Qaeda has appealed to will now be supporting, you know, the birth of democracy in this Arab Spring. And all the New York Times and everyone else sort of dutifully echoed, as they usually do, the administration line on this. The trouble was that Al-Qaeda thought the same thing. They thought, this is great. This revolutionary upsurge will help us. And guess who turned out to be right? And so the administration response was to say, well, we have to get behind moderate Islam, which they identified as the Muslim Brotherhood. But so they endorsed the Muslim Brotherhood takeover in Egypt, and that didn't turn out so well. I mean, tragically, it went very badly wrong and led to this very sort of bloody dictatorship we have now. When in the reaction to that, it enabled the sort of rise of Turkey as an aggressive power in that part of the world, with, I think, disastrous results. So I think it's not fair to say they really don't understand what ISIS is. I think they, you know, have a fair idea, and they're conscious of conditions in the Arab world. And I'm not entirely sure what could be done right now about redressing all those problems. I just want to go back to one thing the last caller said about, you know, the administration not being able to control its, you know, the military and the CIA. There was a very important piece by Seymour Hersh in the London Review of Books recently, where he actually laid out, and I know I'm very aware of, he has some very impressive sources on this, how the military for quite a while, not now, but were resisting the administration's efforts to get more deeply involved in Syria, and were actually sabotaging it, which I think was probably quite a good thing. But it's a very good example of how this administration really doesn't control or hasn't controlled all the levers of power.
Hmm. And Tim, what are your thoughts about that? Because you wrote a book about the secret world of intelligence outsourcing. So what are your thoughts on whether Obama does have control of the military or the CIA, or at least some influence?
Well, actually, I think Obama is a president that's been more controlled by the CIA than almost any president in our history. I mean, he did not have much experience in foreign policy at all when he became president, very little when he was in the Senate. And, you know, John Brennan, who's now the head of the CIA, was appointed as his national security advisor very early in his campaign, and sort of steered him through all these thickets of foreign policy and national security, but really got his ear. And I think he's followed this sort of John Brennan sort of CIA vision of the world very, very, very closely. And I think that's been, you know, very sad to see. One of the more interesting parts of his speech, I thought, was when he started talking about nation building as a recipe for quagmire. And he said, you know, we can't take over and rebuild every country because this will lead to a quagmire. And of course, he was talking about, you know, he mentioned Vietnam and he mentioned Iraq. You know, what he's talking about there is this whole counterinsurgency tactic that the U.S. military adopted in Vietnam, in Iraq, and of course in Afghanistan. And the whole idea behind it is, you know, get boots on the ground, so-called, and rebuild, you know, outgovern the enemy. That's the basic philosophy behind it. And show the people in the middle, the vast people in the middle, that, you know, the U.S. and its allies can outgovern those who are like the Taliban or the Viet Cong in Vietnam and so on. This, you know, he really repudiated that, said that's not going to happen. He's said that before. But the question is, what replaces it? And what's replaced it is what, you know, Andrew's been writing about, is this sort of electronic, you know, drone-driven warfare led by special forces, the joint, you know, JSOC, CIA paramilitary. And so more and more of the wars actually are hidden wars. And so a lot of these military operations and even paramilitary operations, secret operations, we don't know very much about what actually happens. And I think this is sort of the more scarier part of it. Yes, he denounced carpet bombing, which is a tactic that's, you know, never worked and has driven people into the hands of those who are fighting us. But at the same time, you know, you have this, like, massive structure built around, you know, these kind of operations. And very few people, it's not, much of it is not made public. And I think that will continue under Republican rule.
Yeah, I mean, I was going to ask you that, Andrew. What are your thoughts about Obama's legacy on drones and what's to come? I was just thinking about those four former U.S. Air Force service members with more than 20 years of experience operating military drones. And in October, November, they came out and they wrote a letter to the administration saying that drones fuel the feelings of hatred and they are the most devastating driving forces for terrorism and destabilization around the world. It didn't get much media attention, but it was a pretty big deal.
Right. Absolutely. It was very important, and I'm very glad you raised this. And as Tim mentioned, you know, this is the legacy. You know, Obama is a great believer. I think it's in his character. He loves a former senior, someone who'd been in quite high up in his administration, said to me the other day, he said, you know, the president, he's kind of a furtive guy. He likes this undercover special forces, you know, sort of below the radar kind of operation. He loves all this SEAL Team 6 and JSOC and Delta Force operations. And it's very telling, in fact, that there's going to be a change of command at CENTCOM, you know, this giant command apparatus that supervises, you know, the area of warfare, the Middle East, Syria, Iraq, Afghanistan, is all run out of CENTCOM. And the new head of CENTCOM is going to be General Votel, who until previously commanded Joint Special Operations Command, who are the assassins, really, that we've been talking about, and then went on to run Special Operations Command. So they're promoting to run, to be a senior and incredibly powerful proconsul in the violent part of the world, this area of crisis. This guy whose entire background is in these undercover, you know, literally fly-by-night operations. I found that very indicative and rather chilling, and it absolutely reflects Obama's sort of attitude on this sort of thing.
Andrew Coburn is Washington editor of Harper's Magazine and author of Kill Chain, The Rise of High-Tech Assassins. Tim Shorrock is a veteran national security reporter and author of Spies for Hire, The Secret World of Intelligence Outsourcing. Today, we are talking about President Obama's foreign policy and his legacy. Last night, he acknowledged that the U.S. spends more on the military than the next eight nations combined. He's getting criticism for saying conflicts in the Middle East date back millennia. What else really strikes you about foreign policy under President Obama, and how would you describe his legacy? You can join us at 866-798-8255, 866-798-8255. You can also email feedback@yourcallradio.org. We're spending a lot of time on the Middle East, but if you'd like to talk about other parts of the world and how President Obama, how his foreign policy has affected other parts of the world, we'd love to hear from you. And let's go to Harry in San Francisco. Hi, Harry. Welcome to the show.
Yes, good morning. With regard to other parts of the world, you should look at the coup in Honduras, which was supported tacitly by the United States and Hillary Clinton. I wanted to know Mr. Colbert feels the difference would be between Hillary Clinton and Bernie Sanders and Barack Obama in terms of foreign policy. They all seem very similarly aligned in terms of a strong military, a new set of nuclear weapons they're spending an incredible amount of money on, and predator drones and so forth.
Mm-hmm. All right, thank you. Andrew, first, do you want to talk about Hillary Clinton? What changes would you expect from her?
Well, I'd hope some, although the record is not promising. I'm so glad Harry brought up that really disgraceful coup in Honduras, where the elected president was kicked out with the endorsement of Hillary Clinton, and a very noxious and repressive regime took over again with the blessing of the administration. I mean, that's people have forgotten about it, I'm afraid. So we should remember that. I mean, let's talk about Hillary Clinton. Let's talk about Libya, not about all this Benghazi business, but the whole overthrow of Gaddafi, and the sponsorship, basically the active intervention of the United States to destroy the Libyan state. And now we have Libya in a state of sort of semi-anarchy, fought over by marauding jihadis, basically fighting each other for power and loot. And it's absolutely shocking that this gets mentioned occasionally. Actually, I think Donald Trump likes to talk about it once in a while, which is something. On the other hand, we have Sanders. Once you get away from Sanders, all the nice things he says about Wall Street, his prescription for the Middle East, I think I heard a while ago, saying let Saudi Arabia take the lead. Hmm. Saudi Arabia, who compete with ISIS for the number of heads they can chop off, and at least Saudi Arabians have sponsored ISIS's rise. I mean, it shows a level of willful ignorance on his part, and his attitude to the Israeli-Palestinian situation doesn't bear much examination. So I hold out no hope from him. Hmm. In a way, in terms of if the first prescription should be do no harm, I'm afraid, in a way, it's a shocking commentary that some of the more sensible statements have come from Donald Trump and Ted Cruz, which is a terrible reflection on the Democrats.
Well, I mean, during the last presidential election, Ron Paul was the only one that really talked about blowback.
Exactly so, and got derided in the mainstream press for even talking that way.
Tim, do you want to add anything on Hillary Clinton or Bernie Sanders? Bernie Sanders was on Meet the Press last year, and he said he would not end the drone program. He wasn't really asked to elaborate. That's pretty much all we have at this point. He doesn't really spend much time talking about U.S. foreign policy.
No, he doesn't. He basically, I don't really see that much difference between him and Hillary Clinton on foreign policy, because, as Andrew says, he talks about, running military campaigns through our sort of proxy, allies, quote unquote, like Saudi Arabia. And I think this is Honduras. What happened in Honduras is a perfect example of this, because, Honduras is now, very, very close military ally of the U.S., has been for years, and that was one of the reasons the U.S. Under Hillary Clinton, when she was Secretary of State, supported this coup in Honduras. And like today, I was just looking through the news, and I saw a Pentagon release from Central America about U.S. practicing paratroop drops with Honduran forces. And Honduras has been under that government has been very cruel repression in its own country. But that's the outcome of this military action through allies. So who are our allies? It's governments like Honduras. It's governments like in Saudi Arabia. And this is not really a prescription for peace or even reduction of tension. It increases tension and it increases the problem. And one other thing I want to add about all of this is that when Obama spoke when it was 18 months ago about we're ending the war in Afghanistan and so on, these operations in Afghanistan that continue, special forces and these operations in Africa and elsewhere, CIA and special forces, these are heavily contracted operations. And that, I've written some articles for The Nation recently, actually, last year, 2015, about, say, deaths of some contractors in Afghanistan and elsewhere. I mean, basically, they're taking the place of U.S. soldiers, of U.S. boots on the ground. And so, as U.S. military expands in these countries, so does the role of private contractors. And one of the problems of this is that the costs of the war are often hidden from the American people. We don't know. We're not told much about the deaths of these contractors, but a lot of them, you know, they're just working directly with, say, in Afghanistan, with special forces there, you know, running special forces, special operations in different parts of the country against the Taliban. And so, you know, the expansion of contractors, while it makes lots of money for defense contractors and intelligence contractors, it also, you know, hides the results of the war, the horrific parts of the war, the killing, the deaths of Americans, and of course, you know, all the civilians killed. It's a way to sort of hide it from the American people, the cost of the war.
Tim, I think
that's very dangerous.
Have there been any changes under Obama when it comes to military spending? Because this didn't get much media at all, but over the House and the Senate overwhelmingly passed a $580 billion military budget late last year. Now, Bernie Sanders talks about waste in the military budget. You don't hear Hillary Clinton talking about that. So what has really changed under Obama when it comes to military spending?
You know, I'm afraid to say that nothing much has really changed. I mean, I don't have the figures in front of me, but like I said earlier in the program, you know, we're undergoing this massive military buildup in East Asia. That includes, you know, a new Marine base in trying to expand the Marine base in Okinawa. There is a new Marine base in Australia. And of course, all this is aimed at, you know, encircling China, going back to sort of like the Cold War policies of encircling China, the Soviet Union, and so on, and, you know, keeping North Korea from developing its weapons, nuclear weapons, which the result has been very poor. I mean, they've built more weapons in the last few years than they ever did, and so it's, you know, the military spending in particularly in East Asia is enormous. I mean, you know, South Korea is the largest purchaser of U.S. weapons, and Japan is very close, you know, and so I think that nothing much has changed at all.
Well, we have a call about the TPP. Let's go to Edward in Berkeley. Hi, Edward. Welcome to the show.
Hi. I noticed that he mentioned the TPP, but he didn't mention the primary criticism, and that is that the corporations from outside the country can sue local municipalities that when they lose money because of the regulation of the local municipalities, the local place says he doesn't want a certain mercury in their food from, say, some country, some corporation outside the country, they can sue for the loss. That's the major criticism for the TPP, and he didn't even mention that. It seems like it's kind of crazy. Hmm.
Well, so on the TPP, he says that the TPP will result in made-in-America products and support more jobs. With TPP, China doesn't set the rules in that region. We do. You want to show strength in this century? Approve this agreement. Give us the tools to enforce it. Andrew, have you been following the TPP? What are your thoughts on that?
Not as closely as I should, but I mean, what the caller said is absolutely correct. I mean, it really doesn't do much for trade. I mean, this notion that it's going to, you know, produce a lot of employment in this country is specious. And in fact, the record of, you know, previous trade agreements of that, you know, people like that have been the previous presidents have put through really shows the way. I mean, I think NAFTA cost us jobs and wiped out the Mexican small farmer along the way, leading to the immigration, really playing a major role, leading to the immigration issue we have today. I think, you know, he didn't spend that much time talking about it because I think he knows it's dead. I mean, that's one thing we have to thank partisan rancor in the Congress for. I'm amazed at this, but, you know, McConnell has said he won't introduce the trade bill, the trade treaty this year, which must have sent up. I mean, I'm amazed he got that past the U.S. Chamber of Commerce. And it's, you know, it's kind of pathetic that Obama is looking to this very, very flawed and unpleasant trade pact, which is really, an exercise in increasing corporate power at the expense of the rest of us, and very little to do with actual trade. that, you know, Obama's relying on this to sort of be part of his legacy. I think it really shows up the man.
Anything to add, Tim?
Yeah, well, I mean, it goes the other way, too. I mean, a lot of people, farmers, workers in Asian countries are opposed to this because, you know, yes, it expands the export of American products, such as pharmaceuticals. It forces countries to even change their domestic laws to allow, you know, to not restrict, you know, certain drugs to domestic makers and that kind of thing, allow U.S. financial institutions, pharmaceutical companies to expand their markets, and agriculture, too. There's a lot of resistance to it within Asian countries. But again, it goes back to this sort of neo-Cold War that we're engaged in Asia, because it's meant to isolate China. And I think this is the sort of, you know, the interesting thing is South Korea, which is not yet to join the TPP, has very close economic ties with China. And, you know, they're not about to disrupt those ties in favor of an American-led, you know, sort of economic trade regime in all of East Asia. They're not about to do that. And the Japanese have gone along because the Japanese ruling party is probably the most subservient party to the United States of any party in the world. It's basically been in power since 1955, and it's kind of like a proxy army for the United States right now. It's what I call it. But, I mean, you know, this is it's really meant to, it's part of the whole U.S. militarization of policies in East Asia, meant to isolate China, meant to keep the United States in supremacy over economic and political and military affairs in East Asia.
Well, unfortunately, we're going to have to leave it there, but I want to thank both of you for talking today about President Obama's foreign policy legacy. Tim Shorrock is a veteran national security reporter and author of Spies for Hire, The Secret World of Intelligence Outsourcing. Andrew Coburn is Washington editor of Harper's Magazine and author of Kill Chain, The Rise of High-Tech Assassins. Tim and Andrew, thank you for joining us.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you. And you can find their writings and their reporting at yourcallradio.org. I'm Rose Aguilar. This is Your Call. On the next Your Call, we'll discuss right-wing extremism. The Southern Poverty Law Center's annual census identified 276 militia groups last year, a 37% increase from 2014. A group of armed militiamen recently took over a federal wildlife refuge in Oregon. Donald Trump's xenophobic rhetoric has earned him endorsements from white nationalists. So are we in a period of growing right-wing extremism? And what influence does the extreme right have on politics? It's Your Call with me, Rose Aguilar, and you. Support for Your Call comes from the listeners of KALW. To listen to past shows or sign up for our podcast, visit yourcallradio.org. Laura Flynn produces the show, Malihe Razazan is senior producer, Matt Martin is executive producer, and Rosalie Atkinson is our intern. Phil Hartman is our chief engineer, and David LaTulipe is our studio engineer. Our theme music is performed and composed by Live Human. Special thanks to our partners at KUSP in Santa Cruz. You can email us at feedback@yourcallradio.org.